I think perhaps he would make a good king, if he lives. He looked at Morgaine, almost pleading, and she knew he was longing for reassurance, but she had no comfort for him. At last she said, "If he lives, he will be a good king. But I think he will be a Christian king." It seemed that for a moment all the sounds of Avalon were hushed around her, as if the very waves of the lake and the whispering sound of the reeds on the border were silent to hear her say it. "If he survives the quest of the Grail, or if he should abandon it, still his rule will be circled about by the priests, and through all the land there will be only one God and only one religion." "Would that be such a tragedy, Morgaine?" Lancelot asked quietly. "All through this land, the Christian God is bringing a spiritual rebirth here. Is that an evil thing, when mankind has forgotten the mysteries?" "They have not forgotten the mysteries," she said. "They have found them too difficult. They want a God who will care for them, who will not demand that they struggle for enlightenment, but who will accept them just as they are, with all their sins, and take away their sins with repentance. It is not so. It will never be so. But perhaps it is the only way the unenlightened can bear to think of their gods." Lancelot smiled bitterly. "Perhaps a religion which demands that every man must work through lifetime after lifetime for his own salvation is too much for mankind. They want not to wait for God's justice, but to see it now. And that is the lure which this new breed of priests has promised them." Morgaine knew that he spoke truth, and bowed her head in anguish. "And since their view of a God is what shapes their reality, so it shall be. The goddess was real while mankind still paid homage to her, and created her form for themselves. Now they will make for themselves the kind of God they think they want, the kind of God they deserve, perhaps. Well, so it must be, for as man saw reality, so it became. While the ancient gods, the goddess, were seen as benevolent or life-giving, so indeed had nature been to them, and when the priests had taught men to think of all nature as evil, alien, hostile, and the old gods as demons, even so they would become, surging up from within that part of man which he now wished to sacrifice or control, instead of letting it lead him." She said, remembering at random something she had read when she had looked into the books of Urien's house priest in Wales, "And so all men will become even as that apostle, who wrote that they should become as eunuchs for the kingdom of God. I think I care not to live within that world, Lancelot." The weary knight sighed, shook his head. "I think I care not for it either, Morgaine. Yet perhaps it will be a simpler world than ours, and it will be easier to know what is right to do. So I came to seek Galahad, for though he will be a Christian king, I think he would be a better king than Mordred." Morgaine clenched her hands under the edge of her sleeves. "I am not the goddess. It is not mine to choose." "You came here to seek him, Lancelot? He was never one of us. My son, Gwydion, Mordred, he was reared at Avalon. If he left Arthur's court, he might come here. But Galahad? He was as pious as Elaine. He would scorn to set foot in this world of witchcraft and faery. But as I told you, I knew not that I came here," said Lancelot. "I sought to reach Innis Witrin and the Isle of the Priests, for I heard a rumour of a magical brightness which comes and goes in the church there. And they have renamed their well, I have heard, the Well of the Chalice, and I thought perhaps Galahad rode this way. Another old habit brought me here." She asked him seriously then, face to face, "What do you think of this quest, Lancelot?" "I know not truly, cousin," said Lancelot. "When I took this quest on me, I went as once I went to kill old Pellinore's dragon, Do you remember that, Morgaine? None of us believed in it then. And yet I did, in the end, find that dragon and slay it. Yet I know that something of great holiness came into Camelot that day we saw the Grail. And when she would have spoken, he said vehemently, "No! Tell me not that I imagined it, Morgaine. You were not there. You do not know what it was like." For the first time, I felt that there was a mystery somewhere which was beyond this life. And so I went on this quest, though half of me felt it was mad. And I rode a while with Galahad, and it seemed that his faith mocked mine, because he was so pure, and his faith so simple and good, and I was old and stained. Lancelot stared down at the floor, and she saw him swallow hard. That is why, in the end, I parted from him, lest I damage that shining faith. And then I know not where I went, for the fog came down over my mind, and the darkness, and it seemed that Galahad must know all the sins of my life, and he must despise me for them. His voice had risen in excitement, and for a moment Morgaine saw the unhealthy brightness returning to his eyes, as she had seen it in the naked man running in the forest. She said quickly, "Don't think of that time, my dear. It is over." He drew a long, shuddering breath, and she saw his eyes fade. "My quest now is to seek Galahad. I know not what he saw. An angel, maybe. Or why the call of the Grail came so strongly to some and so little to others. Of all the knights, I think only Mordred saw nothing. Or if he did, he kept it to himself." "My son was reared at Avalon. He wouldn't have been deceived by the magic of the goddess," Morgaine thought, and was about to speak and tell Lancelot what he had seen. He had been, in youth, an initiate of Avalon, and he shouldn't be allowed to think of it as some mystery of the Christians. But hearing again that strange note in Lancelot's voice, she bent her head and said nothing. The goddess had given him a vision of comfort. It was not for her to destroy it with a word. She had sought this. She had worked for it. Arthur had forsaken the goddess, and the goddess had scattered his fellowship with a wind blowing from her holy place. And the final irony was this, that her holiest of visions should inspire the most passionate legend of Christian worship. Morgaine said at last, reaching out her hand to him, "Sometimes I believe, Lancelot, that it doesn't matter what we do. The gods move us as they will, whatever it is that we think that we are doing. We are no more than their pawns."
"If I believed that," said Lancelot, "I should go mad once and for all."
Morgaine smiled sadly and said, "And if I did not believe it, I should perhaps go mad. I must believe that I had no power to do other than I have done. Must believe that I never had a choice. A choice to refuse the king-making. A choice to destroy Mordred unborn. A choice to refuse when Arthur gave me to Uriens. A choice to hold back my hand from the death of Avaloch. A choice to keep Accolon at my side. A choice to spare Kevin Harper a traitor's death. And Nimue."
Lancelot said, "And I must believe that man has the power to know the right to choose between good and evil,
and know that his choice has made a difference." "Oh, aye," Morgaine said, "if he knows what good is. But does it not seem to you, cousin, that ever in this world evil wears the face of good? Sometimes I feel it is the goddess who makes the wrong appear the right, and the only thing we can do..."
"Why, then, the goddess would be just such a fiend as the priests say she is," said Lancelot.
"Lancelot," she said, leaning forward to plead with him, "never blame yourself. You did what you must. Believe only that it was your fate and ordained."
"No,"
or I should slay myself at once so that the goddess couldn't make use of me to bring about more evil, said Lancelot vehemently. Morgaine, you have the sight, and I cannot believe it is God's will that Arthur and his court shall fall into Mordred's hands. I told you I came hither because my mind played tricks on me. Without thinking, I called the Avalon barge to me and came here. But now I think, perhaps, I wrought better than I knew. You, who have the sight, can look within the mirror and see for me where Galahad has gone. I will even brave his anger and demand that he leave this quest and return to Camelot. The ground seemed to quiver beneath Morgaine's feet. Once she had stepped unwary into a patch of quicksand, and had felt the mud shiver and slip sidewise. It was like that, as if she must throw herself at once to safe ground. She heard herself say, as if very far away, "You will indeed return to Camelot with your son, Lancelot," and wondered why the cold seemed to suck at her very vitals. "I will look into the mirror for you, kinsman, but I know Galahad not. I may not see anything which is of use to you."
"Yet tell me you will do what you can," Lancelot pleaded.
And she said, "I have told you I will look into the mirror, but it will be with us as the goddess wills. Come." The sun was high now, and as they walked down the hill toward the sacred well, a raven croaked once overhead. Lancelot crossed himself against the evil omen, but Morgaine looked up and said, "What did you say, sister?" Raven's voice said in her mind, "Be not afraid. Mordred will not kill Galahad, and Arthur will kill Mordred." She said aloud, "Arthur will be King Stag still." Lancelot turned and stared at her.
"What did you say, Morgaine?"
Raven said in her mind, "Not to the holy well, but to the chapel. And now, it is the time ordained." Lancelot asked,
"Where are we going? Have I forgotten the way to the holy well?"
And Morgaine, raising her head, realized that her steps had brought them not to the well, but to the little chapel where the ancient Christian Brotherhood held their services. They said it had been built by the Brotherhood when the ancient Joseph had thrust his staff into the ground on the hill called Wirial. She put out her hand and took a sprig of the holy thorn. It pricked her finger to the bone, and hardly knowing what she did, she put out her hand and marked Lancelot's forehead with the streak of blood. He looked at her, startled. She could hear the priests singing softly, "Kyrie eleison, Christe Eliason." She went in quietly and knelt down to her own surprise. The chapel was filled with mist, and it seemed to Morgaine that through the mist she could see that other chapel, the one on Innis Witron, and hear both sets of voices singing, "Kyrie Eliason." And there were women's voices too. Yes, this must be on Innis Witron, for in the chapel on Avalon there were no women. These must be the nuns in the convent there. It seemed for a moment that Igraine knelt beside her, and she heard her voice clear and soft, singing, "Christe eleison." The priest was at the altar, and then it seemed to her as if Nimue was there, her golden hair hanging down her back, fair and lovely as Guinevere had been when she was a young maiden in the convent. But instead of the old jealous fury, Morgaine looked on her with the purest love for her beauty. The mists thickened. She could hardly see Lancelot kneeling at her side. But before her, kneeling at the altar in the other chapel, she could see Galahad with his face raised, shining. And on it was the reflected brightness. And she knew that he, too, saw through the mists into the chapel here on Avalon, where the Grail stood. She heard from the other chapel a ring of tiny bells, and heard, she never knew which of the priests, the one here in Avalon, or the one on Innis Witron. but in her mind it was the gentle voice of Taliesin, murmuring,
"For in that night in which the Christ was betrayed, our master took the cup and blessed it, and said, 'All of you drink of this, for this is my blood, which will be shed for you. So often as ye drink of this cup, do it ever in remembrance of me.'"
She could see the shadow of the priest who lifted the cup of communion. Yet it was the damsel of the Grail, Nimue.
Or was it she herself who set the cup to his lips? Lancelot rushed forward, crying out, "Ah, the light, the light!" and dropped to his knees, his hand shielding his eyes, and then slipped further forward and lay prone on the ground. Under the touch of the Grail, the shadowed face of the young man became clear, solid, real, and the mists were gone. Galahad knelt and drank of the cup. "For as the wine of many grapes was crushed to make a single wine, so as we unite in this bloodless and perfect sacrifice, then shall we all become one in the great light which is infinite." And even as the rapture glowed through his face, the light shining there, he drew a great breath of absolute joy and looked full into the light. He reached out to grasp the cup in his hands and fell forward, slithered to the floor of the chapel, and he too lay there without moving.
"It is death to touch the holy things unprepared."
Morgaine saw Nimue, or was it she herself, cover Galahad's face with a white veil. And then Nimue was gone, and the cup was standing on the altar, only the gold cup of the mysteries, without any trace of the unearthly light. She wasn't sure it was there. It was surrounded by mist. And Galahad lay dead on the floor of the chapel in Avalon, cold and still beside Lancelot. It was a long time before Lancelot stirred. And as he raised his head, Morgaine saw that his face was shadowed with tragedy. He whispered, "And I was not worthy to follow him."
"You must take him back to Camelot," Morgaine said gently. "He has won the quest of the Grail, but it was his final quest. He could not bear that light."
"Nor could I,"
Lancelot whispered. "Look,
the light is still on his face.
What did he see?"
Slowly she shook her head, feeling the cold rise up her arms. "Neither you nor I will ever know that, Lancelot. I know only this, that he died with the Grail at his lips." Lancelot looked up at the altar. The priests had gone quietly away, leaving Morgaine alone with the dead and the living. And the cup, surrounded in mist, still gleamed there, softly glowing. Lancelot rose. He said, "Yes, and this shall come back with me to Camelot, that all men may know the quest is ended, and no more knights seeking the unknown to die or go mad." He took one step toward the altar where the Grail gleamed, but Morgaine flung her arms around him and held him back.
"No, no, it is not for you. The very sight of it struck you down. It is death to touch the holy things unprepared."
"Then I shall die for it," he said. But she held him hard, and soon she felt him give way. He said,
"Why, Morgaine, why must this suicidal folly go on?"
"No," she said, "the quest of the Grail is ended. You were spared to return to Camelot and tell them that. But you cannot take it back to Camelot. No man can hold and confine it.
Those who seek it in faith,"
she heard her own voice, though she didn't know what she was going to say until she said it, "will always find it here, beyond the mortal lands. But if it should go back with you to Camelot, it would fall into the hands of the narrowest of the priests and become a pawn for them." She could feel the tears thickening her voice.
I beg of you, Lancelot, leave it here in Avalon. Let there be, in this new world without magic, one mystery the priests cannot describe and define once and for all, cannot put within their narrow dogma of what is and what is not. Her voice broke. In the day which is coming, the priests will tell mankind what is good and what is evil, what to think, what to pray, what to believe. I cannot see to the end. Perhaps mankind must have a time of darkness so that we will one day again know what a blessing is the light. But in that darkness, Lancelot, let there be one glimmer of hope. The Grail came once to Camelot. Let the memory of that passing never be sullied by seeing it captive on some worldly altar. Leave one mystery and one source of vision for man to follow. She heard her voice go dry until it seemed like the croaking of the last of ravens. Lancelot bowed down before her.
Morgaine, or are you truly Morgaine?
I think I do not know who or what you are. But what you say is true. Let the Grail remain forever in Avalon. Morgaine raised her hand, and the little folk of Avalon came and lifted up Galahad's body, bearing it silently to the Avalon barge. Lancelot's hand still in her own, Morgaine walked down to the shore, where she looked at the body lying in the boat. For a moment it seemed that Arthur lay there, then the vision wavered and vanished, and it was only Galahad, with that uncanny peace and light on his face. "Now you ride to Camelot with your son," said Morgaine quietly. "But not as I foresaw. I think the sight is given to mock us. We see what the gods give us to see, but we never know what it means. I think I will never use the sight more, kinsman."
God grant it.
Lancelot took her hands in his own for a moment. Then he bent and kissed them.
And so at last we part, he said softly.
And then, for all she had said of refusing the sight, she saw in his eyes what he saw when he looked at her. The maiden with whom he had lain in the ringstones, and from whom he had turned away from fear of the goddess. The woman he had gone to in a frenzy of desire, trying to blot out the guilt of his love for Guinevere and Arthur. The woman he had seen, pale and terrible, holding aloft the torch when they had taken him in Elaine's bed. And now the dark, quiet lady, shadowed in lights, who had lifted his son from the Grail and pleaded with him to leave it forever outside the world. She leaned forward and kissed him on the brow. There was no need for words. They both knew it was farewell and benediction. As slowly he turned from her and stepped into the magical barge, Morgaine watched the droop of his shoulders and saw the glint of the setting sun on his hair. It was all white now, and Morgaine, seeing herself again in his eyes, thought, "I too am old." And now she knew why she had never again caught sight of the queen within the land of faery. "I am the queen now. There is no goddess but this, and I am she. And yet beyond this, she is, as she is in Igraine and Vivian and Morgawes and Nimue and the queen. And they live in me too. And she. And within Avalon they live for ever." Chapter 13. Far to the north, in the country of Lothian, word came seldom and unreliably of the quest for the Grail. Morgawes waited for the return of her young lover Lamorak, and then, half a year later, word came to her that he had died on the quest. "He wasn't the first," she thought, "and he will not be the last to die of this monstrous madness, leading men to seek for the unknown. Always I have thought that religions and gods were a form of madness. Look what they have brought on Arthur. And now they have taken my Lamorack, still so young.
Well, he was gone, and though she missed him, and would always miss him in her own way, he had been at her side longer than any other, save only Lot, she needn't resign herself to old age in a solitary bed. She scanned herself in her old bronze mirror, sponged away the marks of her tears, then surveyed herself again. If she no longer had quite the full-blown beauty that had brought Lamorack, dazzled, to her feet, she was still a good-looking woman. There were still enough men in the land, and not all of them could have been caught by this questing madness. She was rich, she was queen of Lothian, and she had her woman's weapons. She was still handsome, with all her own teeth, though now she must blacken her fading eyebrows and eyelashes. They were such a pale gingery colour now. Well, there would always be men. They were all fools, and a clever woman could do with them what she liked. She was no fool like Morgaine, to fret over devotion or virtue, nor a whining idiot like Guinevere, to think always about her soul. From time to time, some tale of the quest, each one more fabulous than the last, would reach her. Lamorack, she heard, had come back at last to Pelennor's castle, drawn by an old rumour of a magical dish that was kept there in a crypt beneath the castle. And there he had died, crying out that the Grail floated before him in the hands of a maiden, in the hands of his sister, Elaine, as she had been in childhood. She wondered what he had really seen. Word came, too, from the country near the Roman wall that Lancelot was dungeoned somewhere in Sir Ectorius's old country as a madman, and that no one dared send word to King Arthur. Then she heard that his brother Bors had come and recognised him, and he had come to his wits and ridden away, whether to follow the quest further or to ride back to Camelot she neither knew nor cared. Perhaps, she thought, with luck, he too would die on this quest. Otherwise the lure of Guinevere would draw him back yet again to Arthur and his court. Only her sensible Gwydion hadn't gone on the quest, but had remained at Camelot, close to Arthur's side. Would that Gawain and Gareth had had the wit to do the same. Now at last her sons had come into the place that should always have been theirs with Arthur. Yet she had another way to know what was happening. Vivian had told her, in her youth at Avalon, that she hadn't the patience nor the hardihood for initiation into the mysteries. And Vivian, she knew it now, had been right. Who would wish to forsake life for so long as that? For many years she had believed that the doors of magic and of the sight were closed to her, save for such little tricks as she had mastered on her own. And then she had begun to understand, when first she had used her sorcery to discover Gwydion's parentage, that the magical art was there, awaiting her, needing nothing but her will. Having nothing to do with the complex druidical rules and limitations about its use, or lies about the gods. It was simply a part of life, there and accessible, nothing to do with good or evil, but available to anyone who had the will and the ruthlessness to use it. All those who pretend to religions, Morgause thought, wish only to keep the sources of power in their own hands. But now I have them freely, and of my own making, without binding myself by oaths about their use or direction. So now, on this night, shut away from her servants, she made her preparations. She felt a dispassionate sympathy for the white dog she had brought in, and a moment of genuine revulsion as she cut its throat and set forth the dish of hot blood she had caught. But after all, it was her own dog, as much hers as a pig she might have slaughtered for the table, and the power of spilled blood was stronger and more direct than the power built up by the long prayers of the Avalon priesthood. Before the fireplace, one of her servant women was lying, drugged and ready, before the fireplace. Not one, this time, for whom she had any affection or any real need. She had learned that lesson when last she had attempted this. She spared a regretful thought for the waste of a good spinning woman that time.
At least this one would be no loss to anyone, not even the cook, who had half a dozen more helpers than she needed. She still felt a certain squeamishness at the preliminaries. The blood marking her hands and forehead was unpleasantly sticky, but it seemed to her that she could almost see, billowing forth from the blood like smoke, the thin streams of magical power. The moon had shrunk to the thinnest of glimmers in the sky, and she knew the one who awaited her call in Camelot would be ready. At the precise moment the moon moved into the proper quarter of the sky, she poured the rest of the blood into the fire, and called three times aloud. Morag! 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 The drugged woman by the fireside, Morgause vaguely recalled that her name was Becca, or something like that, stirred, her vague eyes taking on depth and purpose, and for a moment, as she arose, it seemed that she was wearing the elegant garb of one of Guinevere's waiting women. Her voice, too, was not the rough dialect of the dim-witted country girl, but the careful speech of a southern court lady. "I am here at your call. What would you have of me, Queen of the Darkness?"
"Tell me of the court. What of the Queen?"
"She is much alone since Lancelot has gone, but often calls young Gwydion to her. She has been heard to say that he is like the son she never had.
I think she has forgotten that he is the son of Queen Morgaine," said the girl,
the careful speech so incongruous from the empty-eyed, rough-handed kitchen girl in her shapeless smock of sacking. "Do you still put the medicine in her wine at bedtime?"
"There is no need, my queen," said the alien voice which came
through and behind the kitchen girl. "The queen's courses have not come upon her now for more than a year, and so I have ceased to give her the drug. But in any case, the king comes very seldom to her bed." So Morgause's last fear could now be quieted, that somehow, against all odds, Guinevere would bear a belated child to endanger Gwydion's position at court. Besides, the king's subjects would never accept a child for king after the long, peaceful years of Arthur's reign. Nor, she supposed, would Gwydion have any scruples about making an end to a small, unwanted rival. But it was better not to chance it. Arthur himself, after all, had escaped all Lot's plotting and her own, and had lived to be crowned. "I have waited too long. Lot should have been king of these lands many years ago, and I queen. Now there is none to stop me. Vivian is gone. Morgaine is old. Gwydion will make me queen. I'm the only woman living to whose word he will listen."
"What of Sir Mordred, Morag? Is he trusted by the queen? By the king?"
But the voice grew thick and heavy. "I cannot stay. Mordred is often with the king. Once I heard the king say to him, 'Ooh, my head aches. What am I doing here by the fire? Cook will skin me alive.'" It was the idiot voice of Becca, thick and sullen, and Morgause knew that far away in Camelot, Morag had sunk back into her bizarre dream in which she faced the faraway Queen of Lothian, or the Queen of Faerie. Morgause seized the pan of blood, shaking the last remaining drops into the fire. "Morag! Morag! Hear me. Stay. I command."
"My queen," came the faraway ladylike voice. "Sir Mordred has always at his side one of the damsels of the Lady of the Lake. They say that she is somehow kin to Arthur."
"Ninian, daughter of Taliesin," Morgause thought. "I did not know she had left Avalon. But why now should she stay?"
"Sir Mordred has been named captain of horse while Lancelot is gone from court. There are rumours."
"Ooh, the fire, my lady! Will you set the whole of the castle afire?"
Becca was rubbing her eyes and whimpering on the hearth. Infuriated, Morgause gave her a savage push, and the girl fell screaming into the fire. But she was still bound, and couldn't pull herself away from the flames.
Damn her! She will wake the whole household!
Morgause reached out to pull the girl from the flames, but her dress had caught fire, and her shrieks were dreadful, striking Morgause's ears like red-hot needles. She thought, with a trace of pity,
"Poor girl, there is nothing to be done for her now. She would be so burnt we couldn't help her even if she should live."
She pulled the screaming, struggling girl out of the fire, not regarding the burns on her own hands, and leaned close for a moment, laying her head on the girl's brow as if to soothe her. Then, with a single stroke, she cut her throat from ear to ear. Blood poured into the fire, and the smoke rushed high up into the chimney. Morgause felt herself shaking with the unexpected power, as if she were spreading out through the whole of the room, through the whole of Lothian, through the whole of the world. She had never dared so much before, but now it had come to her, unsought. It seemed that she hovered bodiless over all the land. Again, after years of peace, there were armies on the road, and on the west coast hairy men in high-beaked dragon ships landed, plundering and burning cities, laying monasteries waste, carrying away women from the walled convents where they lived, like a crimson wind sweeping down even to the borders of Camelot. She wasn't sure whether what she saw now was even at this moment moving in the land, or was yet to come. She cried out through the growing darkness, "Let me see my sons on the quest of the Grail." Darkness filled the room, sudden, black and thick, with a curious smell of burning, while Morgause crouched, beaten to her knees by the rush of power. The smoke cleared a little, with a small stirring and coiling in the darkness, like the boiling of a pot. Then Morgause saw, in the widening light, the face of her youngest son, Gareth. He was dirty and travel-worn, his clothing ragged, but he was smiling with the old gaiety, and as the light grew, Morgause could see what he was looking at. The face of Lancelot. Ah, Guinevere wouldn't fawn on him now, not this sickly and wasted man with grey in his hair and the traces of madness and suffering in the lines round his eyes. He looks, indeed, like something hung up in the field to scare birds from the grain. The old hatred surged through her. It was intolerable that her youngest and best son should think kindly of this man, should love him and follow him as he had when he was a little child, prattling to carved wooden knights. "No, Gareth," she heard the voice of Lancelot, soft in the curdled silence in the room. "You know why it is that I will not return to court. I will not speak of my own peace of soul, nor yet of the Queen's. But I am vowed to follow the Grail for a year and a day."
"But this is madness. What the devil is the Grail against the needs of our king?"
"I was sworn to him, and so were you, years before any of us heard of the Grail. When I think of our King Arthur at court, with none of his faithful men, save such as are lame or infirm or cowardly, times I wonder if perhaps it was the work of the fiend, masquerading as a work of God, and come to scatter Arthur's companions out of his hands." Lancelot said quietly, "I know that it came from God, Gareth. Do not try to deprive me of that."
And for a moment it seemed that again the light of madness flickered in his eyes. Gareth said, and his voice was oddly subdued when he spoke, "But when God does the same work as the devil..."
"I cannot think it is God's will that all Arthur has wrought in more than a quarter of a century should thus be cast aside. Do you know there are wild Northmen landing on the shores, and when the men of those lands cry out for Arthur's legions to come and help them, there are none to send to their aid? And so the Saxon armies are gathering again while Arthur sits idle in Camelot, and you seek for your soul.
"Lancelot, I beg you, if you will not return to court, at least seek for Galahad, and make him return to Arthur's side. If the king is old, and his will grows weak, and God forbid I should ever have to say so much, then perhaps your son may stand in his place. For all men know he is the king's adopted son and heir."
"Galahad?" Lancelot's voice was sombre. "Think you I have much influence with my son? You and the others swore to follow the Grail for a year and a day. Yet I rode for a time with Galahad, and I know it is with him, even as he said on that day, that if need be, he would follow it lifelong."
"No!" Gareth leaned from his horse and gripped Lancelot by the shoulders. "That is what you must make him see, Lancelot, that at all cost he must return to Camelot. Oh, God, Gwydion would call me traitor to my own blood. And I love Gwydion well. But how can I say this even to you, my cousin and my heart's brother? I trust not that man's power over our king. The Saxons who send to Arthur find themselves always speaking with him. They think of him as the sister's son of Arthur. And among them, know you not, the sister's son is heir." Lancelot said with a gentle smile, "Recall then, Gareth, that it was even so with the tribes before the Romans came. We are not Roman, you and I." "But will you not fight for the rights of your own son?" demanded Gareth.
"It is for Arthur to say who shall follow him on his throne," said Lancelot. "If indeed there shall be any king after him at all. Sometimes it seemed to me when I wandered among the visions of my madness. Nay, I mean not to speak of that, but I think perhaps it was a little akin to the sight. That a darkness would fall over this land when Arthur had gone. And then it should be as if Arthur had never been." "What of your vow to Arthur?" Gareth demanded. And Lancelot sighed. "If it is your will, Gareth, I will seek out Galahad."
"As quickly as you can," Gareth urged. "And you must persuade him that his loyalty to the king is beyond all quests and grails and gods." Lancelot said sadly,
"And if he will not come?"
"If he does not," Gareth said slowly, "then perhaps he is not the king we will need after Arthur. In that case, we are in God's hands. And may he help us all."
"Cousin, and more than brother," said Lancelot, embracing him again. "We are all in God's hands, whatever comes. But I vow to you, I will seek for Galahad, and bring him with me to Camelot. I swear it."
And then the stirring and the brightness were gone. Gareth's face faded and went into the dark, and for a moment it was only Lancelot's eyes, lustrous, and so like Vivian's that for a moment Morgause felt that her sister and priestess was looking on her with frowning disapproval, as if to say, "Morgause, what have you done now?" Then that too was gone, and Morgause was alone with her fire, still belching smoke from which all the clouds of magical power had faded, and the limp, bloodless body of the dead woman lying on the hearth. Lancelot. Lancelot, damn him! He could still play havoc with her plans. Morgause felt her hate like a pain that struck through, a tightness in her throat that travelled down her body to her very womb. Her head was aching, and she felt deathly sick with the aftermath of magic. She wanted nothing more than to sink down on the hearth and sleep for hours. But she must be strong. Strong with the powers of sorcery she had called to herself. She was Queen of Lothian, Queen of Darkness. She opened the door and flung the body of the dog onto the midden heap there, disregarding the sickening stench. She couldn't handle the body of the kitchen girl alone. She was about to call out for help when she stopped, her hands to her face, still marked and sticky with blood. They mustn't see her like this. She went to the basin and ewer of water, poured it out, and washed her face and hands and braided her hair afresh. There was nothing she could do about the bloodstains on her dress, but now that the fire was out, there was little light in the room. At last she called out for her chamberlain, and he came to the door, avid curiosity in his face.
"What is it, my queen? I heard shouts and screams. Is anything amiss here?"
He held up the light, and Morgause knew very well how she looked to him. Beautiful, dishevelled, as if she could see herself through his eyes in the aftermath of the sight. "I could stretch forth my hand now and have him over the girl's body," she thought, feeling the strange cramping pain and pleasure of desire. And inwardly she laughed, but she put it wilfully aside. There would be time enough for that.
"Yes, there is grave trouble. Poor Becca," she indicated the limp corpse.
"She fell into the fire, and when I would have helped her burns, she grabbed the knife from my hand to cut her throat. She must have been maddened with the agony, poor thing. See, her blood is all over me." The man cried out in consternation and went to examine the lifeless form of the girl.
"Well, well, the poor lass hadn't all her wits. You shouldn't have let her in here, madam."
Morgause was disturbed at the hint of reproach she heard in the man's voice. Had she actually thought of taking this one to her bed?
"I did not call you hither to question my deeds. Take her out of here, and have her decently buried, and send my women to me. I ride at dawn for Camelot."
Night was falling, and a thick drizzling rain was blurring the road. Morgause was cold and wet, and it only annoyed her when her captain of horse came up and asked,
"Are you sure, madam, that we're on the right road?"
She had had her eye on this one for months. His name was Cormac, and he was tall and young, with a hawk-like face and strong shoulders and thighs. But it seemed to Morgause now that all men were stupid. She would have done better to leave Cormac at home and lead this party herself. But there were things even the Queen of Lothian couldn't do. "I do not recognize any of these roads. Yet I know from the distance we have ridden this day that we must be near to Camelot, unless you have somehow lost your way in the fog, and we are riding northward again, Cormac."
Under ordinary conditions, she would have welcomed another night on the road in her comfortable pavilion, with all the comfort she could provide, and perhaps, when all her women slept, this Cormac to warm her bed. "Since I found the way to sorcery, all men are at my feet. Yet now it seems I care for none. Strange. I have sought out no man since word came to me of Lamorack's death. Am I growing old?" She recoiled from the thought, and resolved she would have Cormac with her tonight. But first they must reach Camelot. She must act there to protect Gwydion's interest, and to advise him. She said impatiently, "The road must be here, dolt. I have made this journey more times than I have fingers on my two hands. Do you think me a fool?"
"God forbid, madam. And I too have ridden this road often. Yet somehow it seems we are lost," Cormac said, and Morgause felt she would choke with her exasperation.
Mentally she retraced the road she had travelled so often from Lothian, leaving the Roman road and taking the well-travelled way along the edge of the marshes to Dragon Island, then along the ridge till they should strike the road to Camelot, which Arthur had had broadened and resurfaced until it was almost as good as the old Roman road.
"Yet somehow you have missed the Camelot road, dolt, for there is that old fragment of Roman wall. Somehow or other we are half an hour's ride past the turn to Camelot," Morgause scolded.
There was no help for it now but to turn the whole caravan about, and already darkness was closing down. Morgause drew up her hood over her head and urged her plodding horse through the grey, lowering twilight. At this time of year there should have been another hour of sunlight, but there was only the faintest glimmer of light in the west.
"Here it lies," said one of her women. "See, that clump of four apple trees. I came here one summer to take a graft of apples for the Queen's garden."
But there was no road, only a little track winding upward on a barren hill where there should be a broad road, and above it, even through the mist, there should have been the lights of Camelot.
Nonsense, she said brusquely. We have lost the way somehow. Are you trying to tell me that there is no more than one clump of four apple trees in Arthur's kingdom?
Yet that is where the road ought to be, I swear it, grumbled Cormac.
But he got the whole line of riders, horses, and pack animals into motion again, and they plodded on, rain coming down and down, as if it had been coming down since the beginning of time, and had forgotten how to stop. Morgause was cold and weary, longing for hot supper at Guinevere's table, and hot mulled wine, and a soft bed. And when Cormac rode up to her again, she demanded crossly,
"What now, dolt? Have you managed to lose us again, and miss a wide wagon road once more?"
"My queen, I'm sorry, but somehow... Look, we're back again where we paused to rest the horses after we turned off the Roman road. That bit of rag I dropped, I'd been using it to clean the muck off one of the packs."
Her wrath exploded.
"Was ever a queen plagued with so many damnable fools about her?" she shouted.
"Must we look for the biggest city north of Londinium all over the summer country? Or must we ride back and forth on this road all night? If we cannot see Camelot's lights in the dark, we could at least hear it. A castle with more than 100 knights and serving men, horses and cattle, Arthur's men patrolling all the roads about. Everything that moves on this road is clearly in sight of his watchtowers."
Yet in the end, there was nothing to do but to have lanterns lighted and turn southward again. Morgause herself rode at the head of the line, next to Cormac. The fog and rain seemed to damp out all sound, even echoes, until, through the foggy rain, they found themselves again at the ruined patch of Roman wall where they had turned about before. Cormac swore, but he sounded frightened too.
"Lady, I'm sorry. I cannot understand it."
"Damnation seize you all," Morgause shrieked at him. "Will you have us riding hither and thither on this road all night?"
Yet she too recognized the ruined wall. She drew a long breath, exasperation and resignation in one.
"Perhaps by morning the rain will have ended, and if we must, we can retrace our steps to the Roman wall. At least we will know where we have come."
"If indeed we have come anywhere, and haven't wandered somehow into the fairy country,"
murmured one of the women, surreptitiously crossing herself.
Morgause saw the gesture, but she only said, "No more of that. It's bad enough to be lost in the rain and the fog without such idiot nonsense. Well, why are you all standing about? We can ride no more tonight. Make haste to camp here, and in the morning we will know what to do."
She had intended to call Cormac to her, if only that she might have no leisure for the fear that had begun to steal through her. Had they indeed come out of the real world into the unknown? Yet she did not, lying alone and wakeful among her women, restless, mentally retracing all the steps of their journey. There was no sound in the night, not even the calling of frogs from the marshes. It wasn't possible to lose the whole city of Camelot, yet it had vanished into nowhere. Or was it she herself, with all her men and ladies and horses, who had vanished into the world of sorcery? And every time she came to that point in her thoughts, she would wish that she hadn't allowed her anger with Cormac to set him to watching over the camp. If he were lying here beside her, she wouldn't have that terrifying sense of the world somehow insanely out of joint. Again and again she tried to sleep, and found herself restlessly staring, wide awake, into the dark. Sometime in the night the rain stopped. When day broke, although damp mist was rising everywhere, the sky was free of cloud. Morgause woke from a fitful doze, a dream of Morgaine, greying and old, looking into a mirror like her own, and went out of her pavilion, hoping that she would look up the hill and find that Camelot was, indeed, where it should have been, the broad road leading up to the towers of Arthur's castle, or else that they were on some unknown road, clearly miles and miles from where they should have been. But they were camped by the ruined Roman wall, which she knew to be about a mile south from Camelot. And, as horses and men prepared to ride, she looked up at the hill which should have been Camelot. But the hill was green and grass-grown and featureless. They rode slowly along the road, muddy with the many tracks where they had ridden back and forth half the night. A flock of sheep grazed in a field, but when Morgause's man went to speak with the shepherd, the man hid behind a rock wall and wouldn't be coaxed out. "And this is Arthur's peace," Morgause wondered aloud.
"I think, my lady," said Cormac with deference, "there must be some enchantment here. Whatever it is, this is not Camelot."
"Then in God's name, what is it?" asked Morgause. But he only muttered,
"In God's name, what indeed?"
and had no further answer for her. She looked upward again, listening to the frightened whimpering of one of her women. For a moment, it was as if Vivian spoke again in her mind, saying what Morgause had never more than half believed, that Avalon had gone into the mists, and that if one set out there, either druid or priestess, and not knowing the way, one would come only to the priest's isle of Glastonbury. They could retrace their steps to the Roman road. But Morgause felt a curious growing fear. Would they find that the Roman road too was gone? Was Lothian gone? Was she alone on the face of the earth with these few men and women? Shivering, she recalled a few words of scripture she had heard preached by Guinevere's house priest about the end of the world.
"I say to you, two women will be grinding grain side by side, and one will be taken, and the other will be left."
Had Camelot and all those within it been taken up into the Christian heaven? Had the world ended with a few stragglers like herself left to wander on the face of the stricken world? But they couldn't stand staring at the empty track. She said, "We will retrace our steps toward the Roman road." "If," she thought, "it is still there. If there is anything there at all." It seemed, as she looked on the mists rising like magical smoke from the marshes, that the world had vanished, and even the rising sun was unfamiliar. Morgause was not a fanciful woman. She told herself it was better to move and try to make their way back than to stand in that otherworldly silence. Camelot was real, a place in the real world. It couldn't vanish entirely away. Yet if I had had my way, if Lot and I had been successful in our plotting against Arthur, perhaps the whole land would be like this, silent and desolate and full of fears. Why was it so quiet? It seemed in all the world there was no sound but their horses' hooves, and even these seemed to fall like stones dropped into water, muffled and dying away in ripples. They had nearly reached the Roman road, or where the Roman road should have been, when they heard hoofbeats on a hard road. A rider was coming, slow and deliberate, from Glastonbury. They could make out a dark figure through the fog, some kind of heavy-laden pack animal behind him. After a moment, one of her men cried out, "Why, look there, it's Sir Lancelot of the Lake. God give you good morning, sir." "Hello! Who rides there?" It was indeed Lancelot's well-known voice, and as he came closer, the homely sound of the hooves of horse and pack mule seemed to release something in the world around them. Sounds carried a long way in the fog, and this was a simple sound, dogs barking somewhere, a whole pack of dogs, perhaps quarrelling over their food after a hungry night. But it broke the unworldly stillness with its simple, normal noise.
"It is the Queen of Lothian," called Cormac,
and Lancelot rode toward them, halting his horse before her.
"Well, aunt, I hadn't hoped to meet with you here. Are my cousins with you, perhaps?
Gawain or Gareth?
No, she said. I ride alone for Camelot.
If, she thought irritably, such a place still exists upon the face of this earth.